Episode 253, Julian Reeve, former musical director for Hamilton and CEO of Perfect Equilibrium.
A challenging but kind of fun opportunity to kind of go back through my catalogue of areas in my life to pick my favourite.
I'm Mark Rabin. This is My Favorite Mistake. In this podcast, you'll hear business leaders and other really interesting people talking about their favorite mistakes. Because we all make mistakes, but what matters is learning from our mistakes instead of repeating them over and over again. So this is the place for honest reflection and conversation, personal growth, and professional success. Visit our website at myfavoritemistakepodcast.com.
To learn more about Julian, his company, and more, look for links in the show notes or go to markgraben.com/mistake253. Thanks for taking time to listen. Thanks for being here. If you like the podcast, please rate and review. Now, on with the show. Hi, welcome back to My Favorite Mistake. I'm Mark Graben. Our guest today is Julian Reeve, founder and CEO of Perfect Equilibrium, Inc., a firm that does consulting related to employee burnout and retention and related issues. We'll have a chance to talk about some of that here today. Julian graduated with honors from Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge, England, before embarking on a highly successful career as a musician, educator, and entrepreneur. He performed to millions across six continents around the world as a music director, winning the Los Angeles Drama Critics Circle Award for Best Musical Direction on the Broadway musical Hamilton, before leading its first presentations at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts and in Puerto Rico with Lin-Manuel Miranda in the lead role. Since then, Julian has built four thriving companies in the creative sector, including the London-based boutique talent agency Boland & Reeve Limited, which is now called Collective Agents, and Perfect Equilibrium, Inc., again, in Los Angeles. So of all the words I could have tripped over, I don't know why Los Angeles was it. But Julian, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Thanks for having me, Mark. Great to be here. Yeah, I'm good.
Yeah, well, I'm happy you're here. I'm a big Hamilton fan. As I told you when we prepped, I'm not going to throw typical Hamilton puns or references at you here. As much as I love the show, so we'll avoid that mistake, or maybe I'm making a mistake by not leaning into the fun there. But you know, Julian, I'm curious where your favorite mistake story comes from. If it's from your really interesting music career or the things that you've done since, what would you say is your favorite mistake?
Well, first of all, let me say what a brilliant kind of suggestion this is for a podcast. You know, it's so off the wall, and it's been actually a challenging but kind of fun opportunity to kind of go back through my catalogue of areas in my life to pick my favourite. My favourite actually takes us right back to 1995. I was 21. I was at university in Cambridge in my second year at the time. And I was the music director at the time for a great singer called Mark Rattray. And he was asked to be the lead vocalist for a new production called The Magic of the Musicals. Now, that show, The Magic of the Musicals, was the first ever show, certainly in Europe, that combined all the best shows from all the best West End and Broadway shows in one show. And it was a really big deal at the time. And Mark had done the original tour, which had gone out to calendar, and they'd done a DVD and all that stuff. And he'd been invited back. And they then called me and asked me whether I wanted to be the music director. And of course, I said yes, because, you know, I'm like, okay, this is the start of the big time. This is great. Awesome. Off we go. Now, playing opposite Mark was a lovely woman by the name of Jackie Scott. So she was the leading lady of the show, and she was incredibly talented, incredibly experienced. She'd done, I think at that stage, three or four leading roles in the West End, was incredibly experienced. And so we jumped into rehearsals, and, you know, Carol Todd, very celebrated director, was leading us, and, you know, we get to a great standard, then we get to opening night, lovely reviews. And this is a 3-month sit down and a tour. So off we go and we have fun. And I think that, you know, this whole time is really successful. You know, people are like, yeah, this is great. You know, selling out every night, producers are happy, band are happy, singers are seemingly happy. So we close the tour and we get to the closing night party, and I'm thinking, well, this has been a great success. You know, my career is now off. I'll be off flying around the world doing all sorts of amazing things. And we started to say our goodbyes, and I actually walked outside and walked Jackie to her car. And I just said, Jackie, listen, I just wanted to say thank you. This has been such a great honor and a pleasure to work with you. I've learned so much from you, and you know, I really am so thankful for this experience. And there was I, nicely poised, ready to receive a reciprocal response. And I actually received silence. And there was a pregnant pause, and I could literally see Jackie thinking. And then she just opened up. She said, well, Julian, I wish I could say the same.
Wow. Ooh.
And my heart literally sank into my stomach. And she spent the next 5 minutes illustrating why she'd said that. And it turns out that, and this comes to my favorite mistake, it turns out that I'd spent the last 4 months, if you include rehearsals, seemingly completely unaware, because I didn't have the self-awareness at the age of 21, that I used at that time authority as a way to communicate. So basically, it was my way or the highway. And what this was a kind of quite immature 21-year-old dealing with playing the game at a very high level amongst senior people who are much more experienced. But I basically didn't know how to talk to people. And so I kind of was in this space where it was like I used my authority to kind of get what I wanted because I didn't know any other option, right? So Jackie told me, she gave me several points over the 3 months of mistakes that I'd made. And that ended up becoming my favorite mistake because she told me, once I got over the hurt, I then did some work. I was like, okay, I need to figure this out. And it was lovely. About 12 years later, we actually worked together again on an arena gig in Sweden. And I thanked her for saying what she said. So it was a kind of lovely full circle moment. But that is my favorite mistake because I don't think I'd have been able to be the music director of Hamilton without that mistake mm-hmm. and the lessons learned from it.
Wow. That's a really interesting story. And a couple follow-up questions. I mean, I never pursued music as, a degree program. I certainly never did anything as a conductor. But thinking as a musician, even in college bands, I mean, there is a certain authority model from different conductors and orchestras and bands. I mean, do you think that was modeled? Were you kind of following the pattern of what had been modeled to you by people who, you know, were really experienced and much more senior? Did that just sort of seem natural? Like, well, that's how you conduct yourself as a conductor?
Yes, absolutely. And I'll be honest, and I don't think he would mind me saying this. A lot of that actually came from my father, who was a musician himself. He was a choir leader. So, you know, I'd grown up watching him in rehearsals. That was, you know, a lot of the behavior that I took on. I was also working with, you know, much older people, kind of going back through my career, even probably from the age of 10, I was making music with people who were 10 years older than me. And that stayed fairly consistent, actually, throughout. There was always a big gap. And I think, you know, the combination of the modeling and the kind of need to keep up with a slightly more mature and experienced kind of peer group was probably the reason for all of that. Mm.
So, I mean, it's great that you got that feedback. I mean, it's a cliche, you know, feedback is a gift. It can sting sometimes. You know, it sounds like you took it to heart and learned from it. But it's sort of a shame like that you didn't get that feedback partway through that first show or that first tour. Were there lessons learned maybe, you know, about asking for feedback or inviting it partway through or earlier stages of a production?
Yeah, great question. And yes, absolutely. You know, I had no idea that leaders should ask for feedback at that stage. You know, the way it's really interesting thinking about this now in terms of everything that I know about my work with organizations and how kind of general business operates. Entertainment is actually really quite different. Certainly in the time that I grew up within it, it was, you know, very hierarchical. And, you know, ostensibly, once you were at the top of the tree or at the top of the ladder, you know, you don't look down. You certainly don't ask them if you're doing anything wrong. And, you know, like the fact that you're at the top of the ladder proves that you do everything right, surely. And, of course, the real world doesn't look like that. But yes, I do, you know, I do wonder whether actually anything would have really been very different in 1995, because I wasn't mature enough. I didn't have the self-awareness. I was riddled with perfectionism. And, you know, perfectionism is really tricky when it comes to feedback, because it will stop you from doing the things that you need to do and the work that you need to get on with. So I don't think that feedback any earlier would have actually sunk in. So in a strange way, this was a better lesson in the fact that it was delivered in one fell swoop, if you like, mm-hmm. hard and fast, because it affected me deeply, which obviously had a significant benefit.
Yeah. I know you've studied and you talk a lot about perfectionism, and you've reflected on it in your own life and career. Might be hard to generalize, but in your experience, are perfectionists more open to input because it helps you get closer to that unachievable goal of perfection? Or do perfectionists tend to get defensive because that feedback stings when it's pointed out that they're not perfect?
Yeah. In my experience, it's very much the latter. I think in general, it depends what type of perfectionist you are. So there are three types of perfectionists: self-orientated, other-orientated, and socially prescribed. The socially prescribed perfectionists are those that think that other people expect them to be perfect. And they're often the people that really struggle with feedback, because there's a general feeling that, you know, like if, for example, they are getting a note or they're in a meeting with a superior or a leader, and, you know, a suggestion is made for how they could have worked differently in a project, they will crumble rather than accept that thinking with open arms, because it's proof that they weren't perfect, and because they think that other people expect them to be perfect, they have failed. And so therefore, there's very little in the immediate term, there's very little positive that comes out of that. The perfectionist really does have to kind of recognize their own behavior, recognize their own patterns, and actually do the work beyond the initial response for that to kind of really land.
Mm. So I want to come back, you know, and we'll stay on, you know, this theme of perfectionism, I think. But if we can maybe fast forward about 20 years or so mm-hmm. to when you were conducting and working as musical director for Hamilton, you know, that's, you know, quite the achievement and accomplishment. What led to you leaving that line of work and leaving the music industry to start other things?
Yeah, so 3 months into my job on Hamilton, I had a heart attack. And I was 43 at the time. And they put in two stents and sent me back to work. I went to see a psychologist and kind of started to unravel the reasoning behind the heart attack. So basically my right coronary artery was 95% blocked, which proved to be, you know, the result of 20 years of stress associated with high achievement, everything that goes with that, the constant demands for more, the endless ambition, the zero consideration for work-life balance, all the good stuff. Now, sadly, I was, you know, while I was able to kind of keep the show on the road and myself on the road, my body started to break down. And I, about 8 months after the heart attack, I started to experience a repetitive strain injury, one in the wrist, one in the neck on the right side. They kind of combined around the sort of tennis elbow area just below the elbow on the right. And long story short, I was in Puerto Rico with Lynn, in the early part of 2019, putting on a production over there. And I was in so much pain with this injury. I'd worked through it for 8 months that I just knew I had to quit. And it was the hardest decision I'd ever made because, you know, I'd worked really, really hard to get to the very, very top of my tree. And here I was in the top 1% having to quit. And originally I thought, well, I'm just going to leave the show and then, you know, I'll rest this properly, you know, somewhere between 6 and 12 months. And then I'll come back to it, whatever it looks like, Hamilton or another show. But 2 months into the kind of full-on recovery, the specialist sat me down and said, listen, we think you should do something else. You know, conducting a show, you are physically compromised now to play the piano or to conduct at the level that you were. So think about the quarterback that was at the top of his game and he breaks a leg and he comes back and he's done all the rehabilitation, he's done all the psychological work, but he's never quite the same. That was kind of me. And so I was like, you know what, I need to put all of this experience to good use and help other people avoid going through this and, you know, help other people achieve success in healthier ways. And yeah, so here I am. That's what got me from A to B.
Yeah. And I'll link to it in the show notes, the TEDx talk that you did, you know, telling some of that story and talking about perfectionism, you know, but to ask you to touch on some of that here, what are some of the ways in which perfectionism can be helpful before we talk about some of the downside of it to reach kind of the peak of a profession? And
yeah. You know. Well, I think, you know, ultimately, if I was to come up with a word that would help perfectionists, it's boundaries. And it speaks to what you've just asked me because, you know, adaptive and maladaptive perfectionism are two very different things. Adaptive perfectionism can, you know, really help you achieve the results that you were born to achieve. You know, I do believe that there's a certain element of perfectionism that helps us. It's a really valuable, provided it's healthy and recognized and worked with in the right way. It's a really valuable differentiator. You know, our attention to detail, our, you know, ability to put out incredibly strong content, if we're content creators, or, you know, any output is benefited from adaptive perfectionism, provided it doesn't become maladaptive. Now, the maladaptive side is all the stuff that's well publicized, and, you know, keeps us locked in paralysis, keeps us locked in a place of procrastination, et cetera, et cetera. And that's where it gets tricky. But I think, you know, creating those boundaries and really understanding that, you know, if we utilize self-awareness in the way that we can, if we know enough about ourselves, then we really can kind of build almost a perfectionism profile that allows us to kind of manipulate it in good ways to help us, and by partly getting rid of the bad stuff that doesn't. Mm.
But those boundaries, you know, as you spoke to in the TEDx video, the boundaries don't necessarily mean setting lower standards or having boundaries around how high we aim, correct?
Yes, I think so. I'm a big believer in that. You know, the root of the heart attack really was perfectionism. And so I jumped into all sorts of research, even when I was still on Hamilton, in terms of, okay, well, how can I start to manage myself and the standards of the biggest Broadway show on the planet in healthier ways? And there was huge irony in the fact that the very first book that I read on the subject was called The Gifts of Imperfection by the lovely Brené Brown. An incredible book and opened my eyes in all sorts of ways. But the reason why I say there's a lovely irony in it is that, you know, prior to the heart attack, there were no gifts in imperfection. It didn't exist. And so I would have, you know, if I'd seen that in a bookstore in an airport, I would have walked right by it. Because, you know, that's not a call to action to me, because ostensibly what you're asking me to do is get rid of something that I value. And, you know, I think one of the bigger reasons why I did the TEDx was to answer or stand up to society's call that the way that we should deal with perfectionism is to lower our standards, or to expect less from people, or to expect less from ourselves. I fundamentally disagree with that approach, because we end up failing ourselves. and we don't realize our full potential. And, you know, there is another way, and it's called self-compassion. And it's called keeping those standards high, keeping the bar as high as possible, so that the results can be as good as you can achieve, so that you can go on to realize your full potential. But the key is using self-compassion so that you can be kinder to yourself on the journey to perfection, or as close to perfection as you can get.
Yeah. So, like, practically speaking, when we discover that we've made a mistake, even if it's a small, and I'm not trying to dwell on this, I've had trouble saying Los Angeles, even though I lived in LA County for many years, and LA, a couple of years, LA is easier to say than Los Angeles. I've said those words a lot. But what is, like, a practical way of for me to be kind to myself in terms of what I might think or what I might say to myself after making a mistake?
Sure. You know, I think it's certainly on my research in the subject, I was very taken by the fact that, as you know, us as human beings, we have a tremendous ability to show empathy, to show sympathy, to be compassionate to others. You know, we think about how many times we do that on a daily basis to the people that we love and care about. But we suck at being compassionate to ourselves, because we don't use, there is almost a switch that isn't allowed to be turned on to use that same language. And so this answers your question. This is something I do with clients all the time at the beginning of our work, is to, you know, think of the language that you would use with your best friend or your loved one in exactly the same situation. So we come up with, you know, let's call him Steve. Steve makes a mistake introducing a guest on a podcast, and he trips over the word Los Angeles. Okay. What would you say to Steve to make him feel better? Right. And maybe you can answer that question. What would you say to Steve?
I would probably say it's okay. People stumble all the time. Even professional broadcasters stumble over a word. It happens. Don't worry about it.
Okay. And so that's the start of your self-compassionate language. Now, don't, you know, it's very easy to say that that's going to land and land quickly. You know, this takes practice, like anything. You know, people who meditate and meditate well don't just, you know, download an app and suddenly they're amazing at it. It's like anything. It's like Hamilton. It's like it takes hours and hours and hours, weeks and weeks, months and months of rehearsal before we actually get to perform the standard. No different with self-compassion. And, you know, that's a really easy way to start building that sort of language that you can use in those situations.
So one thing I've heard you say is, you know, perfectionists fail to reach their full potential, which might seem counterintuitive to people. If, you know, perfectionists set the bar really high, that would drive success. You know, recently there's a lot of discussion of Barbara Streisand and her book and the word perfectionist. And, you know, Barbara Streisand did reach, you know, I think pinnacles of many disciplines, singing, acting, directing. But why do you say perfectionists tend to fail to reach their full potential?
Well, I think, you know, what I've come to learn in over the course of, you know, certainly the latter part of my career, and I'm sure Hamilton and the heart attack and the injury all plays into this. But yes, that's a really good example of a perfectionist who has absolutely gotten to the top of her tree, Oscar winning, Emmy, Grammy. She might even be an EGOT.
She is an EGOT. Yeah.
There you go. So, you know, one of very few on the planet that can claim to be there, right? So you would clearly argue that perfectionism helped her, and that being a perfectionist was a good thing. The reason why I say we don't realize our full potential comes back to what I was just talking about, is I was always taught that the results were the only thing. So getting to a performance of Hamilton, or the end of a performance of Hamilton, having not made a mistake, making sure that everybody else is as good as they can be, was my goal every day. And that was my only goal. But I think we have a responsibility to our potential, to fulfill every part of our potential as human beings. And that is way bigger and way broader than results. And sadly, perfectionism often comes with fixed mindset. And if we think with a fixed mindset, we are very closed to new opportunities. We're very closed to feedback. You know, we started this whole show talking about that. And so we don't get to learn, and therefore we don't get to grow. And because we don't grow, we don't, I believe, truly become who we were meant to become. And it would be interesting to have this conversation with Barbara, right? Because, you know, how much has she struggled? Well, I know through my own reading that she has struggled tremendously with perfectionism. But how much has the rest of her life suffered because the perfectionism element in her is so strong? And so I think really, you know, my argument is meant for people who want a broader existence than just to be the best at what they do. And that includes family, that includes travel, that includes, you know, community. So much in there. And I think the older we get, the more we recognize that that is actually arguably more important than it is to wake up one day with the title CEO behind our name or whatever that looks like.
Yeah. In your experience, Julian, were you ever part of a mistake-free performance of Hamilton?
A mistake-free performance of
Hamilton? No, mistake-free, sorry.
Oh.
Performance free of mistakes.
Well, okay, so I can't remember how many performances I actually conducted. It was just shy of 1,000, I think. I made 3 mistakes in the entire run of 1,000 performances. And that was the standard that I held myself to. There was a huge mistake at the Kennedy Center in DC, which was actually second on the list of favorite mistakes. But we don't have time to go into that one. But, you know, I think the answer is I didn't make many mistakes because I trained myself not to. And it's very easy when you're doing the same thing every day to do that, really. You just have to, you know, there's a lot within that, as in preparation. You have to know yourself very, very well in terms of how you perform, your ideal environment. Preparation's key, self-awareness is key, practice is key, all of the stuff. But yeah, I mean, you know, I would say that beyond myself, there was probably never a performance of Hamilton where one mistake or other didn't get made. Somebody might forget a lyric, or somebody might, you know, play a bum note in the orchestra or whatever that looks like. You know, it's difficult when you've got 40 people performing, you know, the fastest Broadway show in history. You know, it's sung at like 144 words per minute or something like that. They figured out quite early on that if you took something like what was the comparison they did? It was something like Oklahoma or one of the more traditional Broadway shows. If you took that show if you took Hamilton and you performed it at the pace of Carousel, that's it. If you took Hamilton and performed it at the pace of Carousel, it would take over 5 hours to perform because it's so dense in its right. in its text, but it's so fast in its speed. So mistakes right. are inevitable.
And early, I'm sure early in the initial run, people didn't know the show. They might not know a mistake, but then we're in an era where people may have watched the Disney Plus recording 40 times and they know the show
right.
front to back, and then they go see it live. They might more likely pick out a mistake, but it's probably not going to, I mean, they're still going to enjoy the show and the experience.
Yeah.
So back to the question of, does the mistake matter?
Well, okay. So I think the mistake matters dependent on where the mistake was made. I think if somebody dries on stage, that's where they forget their lines or they forget their lyrics, then that's one thing. If somebody plays a B natural instead of a B flat in a, you know, an eighth note run at, you know, tempo 168, probably 0.5% of the audience is going to notice. So it really does depend on who makes the mistake and its context, I think, in terms of, you know, how big it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm certainly not an expert on Alexander Hamilton, the man, but, you know, there are some articles, you know, some people say he was a perfectionist, you know, in the way he dressed or maybe the way he wrote or what have you. But there's a quote attributed to Alexander Hamilton I'd love to get your reaction to, Julian. I never expect to see a perfect work from an imperfect man.
Ooh, I love that. I wasn't aware of that. Well, I'm stealing that for my keynotes. Well, it's funny, and talking of my keynotes, I bring it back right at the very end to talk about Alexander, because I obviously speak a lot about stress and burnout. And, you know, I think, I've done enough reading. I know enough about the man to understand that there's definite perfectionistic tendencies in there. I think, you know, bigger than the perfectionism, though, for Alexander, I think his issue really was his desperate need to succeed and his ambition, which, you know, caused a huge amount of stress, which led to burnout. You know, he'd nearly lost his family because of the mistakes he made along the way. And it's interesting to hear him use that quote. Just give me that quote again.
I'll preface it with me wondering out loud, would Alexander Hamilton have applied that to himself the same as he might have to others?
But that's what, yes, that's my thinking, and that's why I wanted you to read it again.
So here it is again. I never expect to see a perfect work from an imperfect man.
Yeah, no, I don't think he's referencing himself at all in any way, shape, or form in that statement. I think he's referencing everybody else because, you know, everyone within reason was inferior to him. And, you know, therefore, he really doesn't believe that anyone can produce at the same standard he can. And because he's perfect, nobody else is. So therefore, his expectation levels are sufficiently low.
Yeah. But one other question, you know, back to what people may be facing in different professions today. Why does perfectionism lead not only just to burnout, but quite often to depression?
Yeah, I think it's a really tricky one, particularly early on when you don't know much about it, because, you know, I think there are, I can't remember which study this was, but there was a study out many years ago that said roughly 35% of the entire world's population struggle with perfectionism in some way, shape, or form. And I can believe that. But I think that many of those people don't really understand that they're perfectionistic in any way, shape, or form. And so they do what I did before I had a heart attack and suddenly realized that, oh, okay, because even prior to the heart attack, I knew that I was perfectionistic, but I didn't really know how affected I was by it. And all of that is to speak to what you just asked, because, you know, I think we all struggle with deeply when we are perfectionistic and not knowledgeable about it. We struggle with identity. We struggle with low self-esteem. We struggle with, you know, the inability to be as good as we need ourselves to be. And that has significant impact on our self-worth, which really is the baseline of everything as far as I'm concerned, which breeds the depression. So the key really is to, if you feel as though you are any way affected from a depression standpoint by perfectionism, then get to the root of the problem. Start to understand your perfectionism. Do you know, there's the multidimensional perfectionism scale, which will tell you exactly what type of perfectionist you are. Then jump into some work with self-compassion. You'll start to feel better. From a burnout perspective, perfectionism can be, you know, very challenging, because, you know, one of the big six reasons we burn out is work overload. And very often, you know, completely inadvertently, we put so much pressure on ourselves to be perfect, we actually add to our own work overload. Yes, the work overload is often the system that we're working in. You know, it's dysfunctional, and that's why, you know, we're kind of drowning a bit as far as burnout goes. But there's a lot of individual work that we need to do to make sure that perfectionism isn't kind of adding to that problem. That's only one problem of burnout that perfectionism affects.
Well, I want to thank you for bringing up, you know, these important concepts of, you know, self-compassion and kindness. I think a lot of times people don't want to talk about or use those words in a business setting. I'm glad you do. Previous guest in this podcast, episode 183, Kristen Neff. I don't know if you're familiar
with her
work on self-compassion.
Yeah.
She was a guest, and, you know, that was really a new phrase, a new concept.
Yeah,
for me being introduced to her work.
Thank you for, you know, introducing the world to Kristen. You know, I mean, I learned so much from her research when I was starting to get into all of this. And I think, you know, it's so important for people like you who have a voice, who have a platform to be promoting this type of message, because I'll be honest and say this is my biggest shock in coming out of entertainment and into the business world. Is that how much these phrases are just not accepted still, even now, either culturally from C-suite or baseline from leaders individually. You know, they still struggle to allow these words to not mean that they're weak or inferior or anything like that. You know, these words, self-compassion is a superpower as far as I'm concerned. Yet it's still regarded as kind of this sort of soft and lazy phrase that's only really supposed to be used for other people, right?
Yeah. Well, and it seems like it would be bad advice to tell people to toughen up. You need to be more resilient, or like somehow blaming people for being burned out. That seems a wholly ineffective and unkind approach. If somebody has an employee who seems burned out, like what are some tips that you would give to leaders if they suspect, not themselves, but somebody they see at work might be burned out?
The biggest issue that I see all the time is trust. You know, we don't put our hand up and ask for help because we don't trust that we can. So, you know, the first thing I encourage leaders to do is to create that safe space, is to create the safe space for employees so that they can feel that they can, you know, come and talk to a leader or to a manager without any repercussion. That's the biggest fear. And, you know, sadly, so many organizations are reliant on, you know, engagement tools or some form of check-in at a computer where, you know, ostensibly you're never going to get a truthful answer because the employees are scared of what may or may not happen. So you have to create an environment where they feel as though they can tell the truth. And then you can start to get, you know, into the weeds. Well, why are you burned out? And then you can take it from there.
And it's sad how often people don't trust that the supposedly anonymous online survey, they think it's supposedly anonymous. Like they're told it's anonymous. And if the level of trust is so low, unfortunately, people are, I don't even know.
That's a lot of the reason why I do what I do in organizations, because I truly believe, and this, you know, isn't trying to position myself in kind of a positive way. I truly believe that, you know, an employee isn't going to be 100% truthful with an employer, and that there needs to be an intermediary, that there needs to be something in the middle. And that's really where I come in, because, you know, I'm very, very clear with C-suite as well as the employees that, you know, I'm very clear in terms of what data is shared and what isn't, because there's no point in me being there unless I do some good. And there's no point in me being there if I'm still going to get the same answers as, you know, an employer would do on any degree of testing or check-in. So, yeah, it's really important.
And as we wrap up, again, our guest today has been Julian Reeve, founder and CEO most recently of his company, Perfect Equilibrium, Inc. Tell us a little bit more about the range of services, you know, for individuals and for organizations.
Yeah, I mean, individually, I'm just about to roll out an AI platform called Pepper, which leverages ChatGPT to become your personal stress and burnout coach. We do everything from one-to-one coaching to cohort coaching, cohort in late January 24. From a organization perspective, it's everything from keynotes to you know, consultancy that allows you to really get to the root of the problem quickly. I, you know, specialize in a 90-day program that, you know, really kind of allows you to fully understand what your culture is, where the bumps are as far as stress and burnout goes, and how you can quickly fix them and fix them with minimal fuss. I think one of the bigger fears for organizations is that, you know, this is going to take a really long time. It's going to be really expensive. And actually, that's not necessarily true. You just need to be really strategic in terms of what you do when and how you implement these changes. And that's really what I do at organizational level.
Yeah. And I'll make sure there are links in the show notes to Julian's company. And one thing I noticed on the website, there's an online course, Overcoming Stress and Burnout, that seems well worth checking out. But, you know, really, Julian, really appreciate you, you know, sharing your not just your own personal story, but the insights that you've gained from research and working with others around, you know, burnout and perfectionism. And maybe just kind of leave it to you with, it's always, I don't know, it always feels like an unfair, open-ended question. Is there anything else you'd want to share with the audience about dealing with or learning from mistakes that we haven't been able to touch on today?
Yeah, well, it kind of just doubles down on the arguably the smaller part of what we touched on today, which is the self-compassion element. Is if you can learn to use the same language as you use with others for yourself, you're well on your way to be able to kind of realize what I would say is your full potential. Because you've got the fuel to get to the goals that you set for yourself in healthier kind of ways. And that, for me, is where things get really exciting. Hmm.
Great words to end on. Julian Reeve, Perfect Equilibrium, Inc. Thank you so much, Julian, for being our guest here today.
Thanks for having me, Mark. Thank you.
Of course.
Thanks again to Julian Reeve for being a wonderful guest today, for his stories and insights and conversation. To learn more about him and his company, look for links in the show notes or go to markgraben.com/mistake253.
As always, I want to thank you for listening. I hope this podcast inspires you to reflect on your own mistakes, how you can learn from them or turn them into a positive. I've had listeners tell me they started being more open and honest about mistakes in their work. And they're trying to create a workplace culture where it's safe to speak up about problems, because that leads to more improvement and better business results. If you have feedback or a story to share, you can email me, myfavoritemistakepodcast@gmail.com. And again, our website is myfavoritemistakepodcast.com.